Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 946. In your Facebook, a virtual panopticon part 2. This is being recorded on February 9th of the year 2017. On July 4th weekend of 2010, not quite 7 years ago, I recorded a program for the record 718, titled In Your Facebook, a Virtual Panopticon? And in that I talked about the new and then new and wildly popular social media site Facebook. And whereas the general perceived consensus was that Facebook was a wonderfully liberating and enabling entity that was just going to put the world at everybody's fingertips, I caution, it may actually put everybody at the world's fingertips. A panopticon is a type of prison envisioned centuries ago in which the prisoner could never see his or her jailers, but the jailers could see their prisoner at all times. And obviously, in For the Record 718, again, recorded on July 4th weekend of 2010, I asked what was frankly then and most assuredly now a rhetorical question, which is, is it really liberating or empowering, or is it actually imprisoning? Does it really put you at the disposal of some very powerful and insidious interests whom you really cannot perceive accurately? Among the things that I spoke about in For the Record 718 was the fact that InQtel, the CIA's venture capital arm, had put some money into the creation of Facebook, and one of the major focal points of For the Record 718 was a guy named Peter Thiel, T-H-I-E-L. He was a major investor in Facebook, still is, although he recently sold off a bunch of stock. I believe he is now the seventh largest holder, stockholder in Facebook. I believe at one time he was the largest. He certainly was a major investor. Peter Thiel is, I am convinced, underground Reich. He is of German extraction. His father was a chemical engineer from Frankfurt, Germany, the headquarters of the old IG Farben company, now broken into several component firms which are a mainstay of, at one level, the Bormann Capital Network in corporate Germany, and at another, are mainstays of the world's pharmaceutical and chemical industry. Bayer, BASF, and the former Hoechst company being central among those. Peter Thiel, I am convinced, is underground, right? He served for a time with Sullivan and Cromwell, and Peter Thiel is in everybody's drawers to some extent or another. He is fantastically wealthy, also very intelligent and foresighted, and an incredibly selfish and, frankly, malevolent individual. He not only is explicitly opposed to democracy in part because it is inimical in his view to wealth creation, but also because he does not think women should be allowed to vote, which is more than a little interesting. I wonder how Sheryl Sandberg, a key figure with Facebook, feels about that. In any event, I warned about Peter Thiel and Facebook back in For the Record 718. In the intervening years, Peter Thiel has emerged as not only a major figure on the far right, but one of the driving forces behind the Trump campaign and a key member of the Trump transition team. Peter Thiel has been networking with many people, including Eric Prince, the founder of the artists, formerly known as Blackwater. His, that is Eric Prince's, sister is Betsy DeVos, the new head of education. And Eric Prince has been a key advisor to Donald Trump on national security matters, a key contributor to Donald Trump's campaign, and apparently also someone who worked with, among others, Rudy Giuliani and people within the FBI to help manipulate James Comey's behavior, in which his last-minute disclosure that he was investigating Hillary Clinton, in the opinion of many, helped to swing the election to Donald Trump. Well, Peter Thiel is no secret anymore, and Facebook, just like WikiLeaks, which I warned about in, for the record, 724, 725, and then 732, and on later shows, 745, 755, and 917. WikiLeaks, just like Facebook, is as far to the right as you get. And that actually became fairly clear during the campaign, in which WikiLeaks was working directly with Roger Stone, the veteran Republican dirty tricks operative whose political CV traces back to Richard Nixon's Watergate dirty tricks squad. Facebook, kind of like those old 1950s monster movies in which some sort of creature gets irradiated or gets enlarged and empowered by chemical waste, and it's preying on people and grabbing them off of bridges or out of boats, or when they're walking by the beach and you see a tentacle come out and snatch somebody out of view, and they may or may not find the mangled body the next day, or maybe that gets devoured. At some point, the monster comes out of the water and you see it for what it is in its entirety for the first time. In a way, Facebook has done just that. In this sequel to, for the record, 718, in your Facebook, and then in parentheses, a virtual panopticon, question mark, there is no question mark. And I think the reasons for that will be seen. So, for the record, 946, a sequel to, for the record, 718, in your Facebook, a virtual panopticon, part two. Let's start with the reading of a significant article from New York Magazine of November 9th of 2016. This is called Donald Trump Won Because of Facebook by Max appropriately, Reed, capital R-E-A-D, is the gentleman's last name. After ticking off a number of contributing factors to Donald Trump's, to many, surprising win in the election, the author goes on to say, skipping down, still, it can be clarifying to identify the conditions that allowed access to the highest levels of the political system, a man so far outside what was until recently the political mainstream that not a single former presidential candidate from his own party would endorse him. In this case, the condition was Facebook. To some extent, I'm using Facebook here as a stand-in for the half-dozen large and influential message boards and social media platforms where Americans now congregate to discuss politics. But Facebook's size, reach, wealth, and power make it effectively the only one that matters. And boy, does it matter. At the risk of being hyperbolic, I think there are few events over the last decade more significant than this social network's wholesale acquisition of the traditional functions of news media, not to mention the political party apparatus. Trump's ascendancy is far from the first material consequence of Facebook's conquering invasion of our social, cultural, and political lives, but it's still a bracing reminder of the extent to which the social network is able to upend existing structure and transform society, and often not for the better. The most obvious way in which Facebook enables a Trump victory has been its inability or refusal to address the problem of hoax or fake news. Fake news is not a problem unique to Facebook, but Facebook's enormous audience and the mechanisms of distribution on which the site relies, i.e. the emotionally charged activity of sharing, and the show-me-more-like-this feedback loop of the news feed algorithm, makes it the only site to support a genuinely lucrative market in which shady publishers arbitrage traffic by enticing people off Facebook and onto ad-festooned websites using stories that are ultimately made up, incorrect, exaggerated beyond all relationship to the truth, or all three. All throughout the election, these fake stories, sometimes papered over with flimsy parody site unquote disclosures somewhere in small type, circulated throughout Facebook. The Pope endorses Trump. Hillary Clinton bought $137 million in illegal arms. The Clintons bought a $200 million house in the Maldives, or Maldives. Many got hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of shares, likes, and comments. Enough people clicked through to the posts to generate significant profits for their creators. The valiant efforts of Snopes and other debunking organizations were insufficient. Facebook's labyrinthine sharing and privacy settings mean that fact checks get lost in the shuffle. Often, no one would even need to click on and read the story for the headline itself to become a widely distributed talking point repeated elsewhere online or sometimes in real life. Profit motive on the part of Macedonians or Americans was not the only reason to share fake news, of course. There was an obvious ideological motivation to lie to or mislead potential voters. But the fake news industry's commitment to engagement, unquote, above any particular political program has given it a terrifyingly nihilistic sheen that old-fashioned propagandists never displayed. Say what you will about something, I can't say that on the air, at least it's an ethos. And at the heart of the problem, anyway, is not the motivations of the hoaxers, but the structure of social media itself. Tens of millions of people invigorated by insurgent outsider candidates and anger at perceived political enemies were served up or shared emotionally charged news stories about the candidates because Facebook's sorting algorithm understood from experience that they were seeking such stories. Many of those stories were lies or parodies, but their appearance and placement in a news feed were no different from those of any publisher with a commitment to, you know, not lying. As those people and their followers clicked on, shared, or otherwise engaged with those stories, which they did because Trump drives engagement extremely bigly, they were served up even more of them. The engagement-driving feedback loop reached the heights of Facebook itself, which shared fake news to its front page on more than one occasion after firing the small team of editorial employees tasked with passing news judgment. Flush with Trump's uniquely passionate supporter base, Facebook's vast, personalized sewer system has become clogged with toxic fatbergs. And it is truly vast. Something like 170 million people in North America use Facebook every day, a number that's not only several orders of magnitude larger than even the most optimistic circulation reckonings of major news outlets, but also about 1.5 times as many people as voted on Tuesday. 44% of all adults living in the U.S. say they get news from Facebook, and access to an audience of that size would seem to demand some kind of civic responsibility, an obligation to ensure that a group of people more sizable than the American electorate is not being misled. But whether through a failure of resources, of ideology, or of imagination, Facebook has seemed both uninterested in and incapable of even acknowledging that it has become the most efficient distributor of misinformation in human history. Facebook connected those supporters, meaning Trump supporters, skipping down, to each other and to the candidate, gave them platforms far beyond what even the largest establishment media organizations might have imagined, and allowed them to effectively self-organize outside the party structure. Who needs a GOTV database when you have millions of voters worked into a frenzy by 9 months of sharing impassioned lies on Facebook, encouraging each other to participate? Even better, Facebook allowed Trump to directly combat the hugely negative media coverage directed at him simply by giving his campaign and its supporters another host of channels to distribute counter-programming. This precisely is why more good journalism would have been unlikely to change anyone's mind. The Post, that's Washington Post, and the New York Times no longer have a monopoly on information about a candidate. Endless reports of corruption, venality, misogyny, and incompetence merely settle in a Facebook feed next to 100 other articles from pro-Trump sources if they settle into a Trump supporter's feed at all. Disputing or ignoring the deeply reported claims, or, as is often the case, just making up new and different stories. More about what is capable now with Facebook. And bear in mind, in an earlier show, I mentioned the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk, and I believe it is more than just the novel it purports to be. I believe it is actually a political manifesto in that the Third Reich goes under, in that being a Serpent's Walk, the Third Reich goes underground, the SS build up their economic muscle, we know both of those happened, they buy into the opinion-forming media, and after a series of terrorist incidents using weapons of mass destruction and a declaration of martial law, they have infiltrated the military and they take over the U.S. Donald Trump's top advisor now, outranking both the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the National Director of Intelligence on the National Security Council, Steve Bannon, was the head of Breitbart. Facebook is another of those opinion-forming media, as is WikiLeaks. So what we are seeing is sort of a cyber serpent's walk taking place here.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
More about what has been appearing on Facebook, or in this case, not appearing on Facebook, from the Pando Daily of January 21st of the year 2017. Hundreds of thousands of women marching protest against Trump. Facebook News tries to silence them all. This by Paul Bradley Carr, C-A-R-R. We don't usually post on Pando at the weekend, but this is too topical and too shameful to wait until Monday. As you certainly know, today is the day of the Women's March on Washington in protest of Donald Trump. The main event is in D.C., where something close to 500,000 protesters of all genders and ages have packed the streets, but there are also major protests in Chicago, New York, and around the world, including Antarctica. You certainly know this because the protest march is the top story on every major news outlet, and because updates and photos from the event are flooding your Twitter and Facebook feeds. And yet, here's what Facebook's trending news feed looked like at the height of the march. Notice anything missing, like, say, 500,000 women? In case you think I'm seeing something different from the rest of the world, be assured that I'm not. Skipping down Facebook's trending news feed really has obliterated the entire Women's March in favor of stories about pastry chefs and professional wrestlers. I've written plenty, and most recently this, about Facebook's increasing coziness with Donald Trump, and there's plenty more to be written about the growing unhappiness inside the company with the rightward direction that senior management are taking in an attempt to please the incoming administration. Stay tuned. Well, indeed, Facebook, in what some would see as good news, is changing its algorithm. This from Social Media Week, an article by Katie Perry, P-E-R-R-Y. I don't know that this is the same Katie Perry as the pop singer. I don't know. But in any event, it is someone who writes under the name of Katy Perry, whether it is the celebrity singer, I do not know. People want to know why the Women's March was absent from Facebook trending news. This from Social Media Week of January 23rd of 2017. Some people are questioning why the Women's March was absent on Facebook's trending news section on January 21st. Other users say they failed to see the inauguration on the list the day prior. Skipping down. Something puzzling happened on January 21st. Despite the Women's March capturing mainstream and local media attention and spurring a flood of photos and commentary from those who marched, some users noted that the event was nowhere to be found within Facebook's trending topics list. For Pando reporter Paul Bradley Carr, it didn't even appear within the political subsection of trending topics. Other onlookers seem to have verified Carr's finding. However, some people did see limited coverage within the political subsection, for example. So far, Facebook has declined to comment, which has left room for rapid speculation as to whether this was a mere technological glitch or something more deliberate. By Sunday evening, January 22nd, the march had made its way to my news feed. And there have been questions about what was going on. An interesting observation here, this from National Public Radio of January 25th of 2017 by Laura Seidel, S-Y-D-E-L-L. Facebook tweaks its trending topics algorithm to better reflect real news. This would seem to augur more positively to those who question why the Women's March sort of disappeared from Facebook's trending news. Skipping down, according to Facebook, the trending topics seen to the right of the main news feed on desktop and in search on mobile are, quote, based on a number of factors, including engagement, timeliness, pages you've liked, and your location. Skipping down. Facebook representatives told NPR that the reason why some people did not see the march as trending had to do with the algorithm behind the feature. Although it took into account major news events and what's popular on the site, it also accounted for the preferences of each person. And Facebook says none of this will happen in the future. Skipping down. Well, they have changed their algorithm in the following manner. The latest algorithm changes are part of Facebook's ongoing effort to curtail the spread of fake news. Some fabricated stories show up in trending topics, despite often originating on sites with no history of visitors and getting no coverage from legitimate news media. That would appear to augur, if not well, at least better for the future. However, what that article does not mention is who are the people who are helping to shape the, quote, new, unquote, Facebook news feed. From BuzzFeed of January 6th of 2017, an article by Molly Hensley, H-E-N-S-L-E-Y-Clancy, C-L-A-N-C-Y. Facebook's new head of news has close ties to conservative politics. This reads in part, Campbell, C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L, Brown, a former TV news anchor and education reform activist, boy, does that belong in quotes, has personal and professional links to Betsy DeVos, Trump's nominee for education secretary. Facebook has chosen Campbell Brown, a former television news anchor who worked most recently as an education reform activist, as its head of news partnerships, with building relations with news outlets in the wake of a wave of fake news stories that dominated the site during the presidential election. Campbell Brown has longstanding ties not just to the traditional news media, but also to conservative politics, although she describes herself as a political independent. She is a close personal friend of Betsy DeVos, the Republican megadonor who is Donald Trump's nominee for education secretary. She has now been confirmed. And, this being Campbell Brown, is married to Dan Senior, or Senior, S-E-N-O-R, a former top advisor to Mitt Romney, who also served as spokesperson for the Coalition Provisional Authority in the wake of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Skipping down. And alongside her mainstream media experience, Brown is familiar with the world of non-traditional news outlets springing up online. In 2014, she founded a non-profit news site, The 74, which bills itself as non-partisan, but which critics have said functions as advocacy journalism tilted in favor of charter schools and against teachers' union. The site was launched with money from donors, including the foundation run by Betsy DeVos, Brown's friend and Trump's proposed education secretary. When the nomination was announced, Brown said she would recuse herself from the 74's coverage of DeVos. Well, not something that I think augurs well for the future of Facebook News, nor does this. This from Axios of January 16th of 2017. This is by Mike Allen, Axios AM, and it says this. Good Monday morning, Martin Luther King Day, Jr. Day is a perfect time to reflect on historic days for our country as we head into Inauguration Week. It's 3 days and a wake-up till President Trump. Scoop, Facebook adds a well-known operative. Tucker, T-U-C-K-E-R, Bounds, capital B-O-U-N-D-S, co-founder of Sidewire, capital S-I-D-E-W-I-R-E, the online conversation platform, is stepping away from his operational role and returning to Facebook, where he was director of corporate communications from 2011 to 2014. Tucker, who'll keep his seat on the Sidewise board, starts January 30th as communications director, focused on product communications, specifically on newsfeed. What is not mentioned here, but what I will have a link to in the description, is the fact that Tucker Bounds is also a spokesperson for the Palin and McCain campaign. He was a McCain advisor and, again, a spokesperson for John McCain and Sarah Palin's 2008 campaign. He now is Facebook's communications director, focused on product communications, specifically on newsfeed. Well, between Campbell Brown and Tucker Bounds, I don't think things are, well, I think that a lot that may be out of bounds now will come into the Campbell's soup of Facebook news feed.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Still more about who is behind Facebook and the links, not only with the Trump regime, but arguably its most odious and certainly brilliant and far-sighted operative Stephen Bannon. From the New York Times of January 19th of 2017, the secret agenda of a Facebook quiz, this by Mackenzie Funk. Skipping down. For several years, a data firm eventually hired by the Trump campaign, Cambridge Analytica, has been using Facebook as a tool to build psychological profiles that represent some 230 million adult Americans. A spin-off of a British consulting company and sometime defense contractor known for its counterterrorism psyops work in Afghanistan, the firm does so by seeding the social network with personality quizzes. Respondents, by now hundreds of thousands of us, mostly female and mostly young enough, male and older for the firm to make inferences about others with similar behaviors and demographics, get a free look at their ocean scores. Cambridge Analytica also gets a look at those scores, and thanks to Facebook, gains access to their profiles and real names. A virtual panopticon. Well, not so bad, you say. Well, Cambridge Analytica may have gone to work for Donald Trump, but who's really behind it? Well, gee, I'm glad you asked. Who is behind this stunning outfit that basically is using the Facebook virtual panopticon? Cambridge Analytica worked on the Leave side of the Brexit campaign, Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party, very close to Steve Bannon. That is no accident. Continuing. In the U.S., it takes only Republicans as clients. Senator Ted Cruz in the primaries, Mr. Trump in the general election. Cambridge Analytica is reportedly backed by Robert Mercer, M-E-R-C-E-R, a hedge fund billionaire and a major Republican donor. A key board member is Stephen K. Bannon, the head of Breitbart News, who became Mr. Trump's campaign chairman and is set to be his chief strategist in the White House. In the age of Facebook, it has become far easier for campaigners or marketers to combine our online persona with our offline selves, a process that was once controversial but is now so commonplace that there is a term for it, onboarding, unquote. Cambridge Analytica says it has as many as 3 to 5,000 data points on each and every one of us, be it voting histories or full-spectrum demographics, age, income, debt, hobbies, criminal histories, purchase histories, religious leanings, health concerns, gun ownership, car ownership, home ownership, from consumer data giants. No data point is very informative on its own, but profiling voters, say Cambridge Analytica, is like baking a cake. Quote, it's the sum of the ingredients, its chief executive officer Alexander Nix told NBC News. Because the U.S. lacks European-style restrictions on second or third-hand use of our data, and because our freedom of information laws give data brokers broad access to the intimate records kept by local and state governments, our lives are open books, even without social media or personality quizzes. In some of my discussions of Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, some listeners may have been put off by my support for the NSA under the circumstances, and I am supportive of the NSA, warts and all. It also, the bulk of what outraged people about the Snowden, quote, disclosures, unquote, was information that's been known for the better part of 20 years. I don't think the NSA is anywhere near up to the task at hand. What we really need is a cyber affairs agency in which NSA and other institutions concerned with national security would handle those aspects of that. But when people are online, whether they're using the internet and or social media and or mobile technology, people have asked me, well, what should I be worried about? Damn near everything else. And what, at least theoretically, you have some input on what the NSA is restricted from doing. Not so with Facebook or WikiLeaks or anything else. And just how scary this stuff can be. Well, just take a look at Cambridge Analytica. Now, about the Mercers, who are the driving force behind Cambridge Analytica. This from the Atlantic Magazine of January 27th of 2017 by Rosie Rosie Gray, G-R-A-Y. What does the billionaire family backing Donald Trump really want? The Mercers are enjoying more influence than ever with their candidate in the White House, but no one seems to know how they intend to use it. Skipping down. Speaking of the Mercers, their top political guru is Steve Bannon, the former Breitbart News chairman and the White House chief strategist. They're close, too, with Trump's campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, who also has a senior role in the White House. They never speak to the press and hardly ever even release a public statement. Like Trump himself, they followed the standard playbook for how things are done in politics. Skipping down. Of the Mercers. That first goal has been clear for some time. The Mercers have for years had their hands in the cottage industry of anti-Clinton activity in and around the conservative movement. According to tax records from the Mercer Family Foundation, they gave nearly $3.6 million to Citizens United between 2012 and 2014, which sued for access to Clinton Foundation-related emails last year, and whose president, David Bossig, also got a senior job on the Trump campaign. They've also invested in the Government Accountability Institute, which publishes the conservative author Peter Schweitzer. Schweitzer's book, Clinton Cash, was an influential source of talking points for Trump allies during this election cycle, providing fodder for one of Trump's early salvos against Clinton in a speech in June, and regularly populating the pages of Breitbart. Bannon co-founded GAI with Schweitzer. Rebecca Mercer, Robert's wife, has sat on the board. Skipping down. Another of the Republican operatives described Bannon as the Obi-Wan Kenobi to Rebecca Mercer, Robert Mercer's wife, and the third was even more pointed. Svengali, Bannon is really, really, really influential, unquote, with Mercer, said the former Breitbart employee. The Mercers, the former employee said, made their wishes known through Bannon, who would sometimes cite the company's financial backers as a reason for Breitbart not to do a story. Bannon didn't respond to a request for comment about this. So once again, as we begin looking at the really scary possibilities, you know, the realities of Facebook, we're coming back to people like Steve Bannon, whom former Obama UN Ambassador Susan Rice, in a rare moment of lucidity, described as a, quote, Nazi, unquote. And again, when Susan Powell, someone I don't think too much of, can tell it like it is, you know it is very late in the day indeed. And so just look how much power Steve Bannon is wielding inside not only the Trump administration, but inside of online social media and related institutions. Take a look at how powerful Steve Bannon is in the virtual panopticon. And I've discussed some of the amazing technology and some of the outrageous things that Facebook has been engaged in. They now have an app that will permit Facebook to turn on your phone without your knowledge or explicit permission. They are now working with credit agencies to develop credit ratings for people on the basis of their friends, people who are associates and friends of theirs, this coming from Facebook. So in other words, if you want to take out a loan or get a credit card or something along those lines and have bad credit, it may be because a friend of yours or friends of yours have bad credit and because the credit agency is getting that from Facebook. Facebook also has a face recognition software and function that is better than the NSA's. More about the capabilities of this virtual panopticon. This from NextGov.com, originally from the Quartz, Q-U-A-R-T-Z blog. This by Dave Gershgorn, G-E-R-S-H-G-O-R-N, from February 2nd of 2017. Facebook quietly used artificial intelligence to solve problem of searching through your photos. For the past few months, Facebook has secretly been rolling out a new feature to U.S. users, the ability to search photos by what's depicted in them rather than by captions or tags. The idea itself isn't new. Google Photos had this feature built in when it launched in 2015. But on Facebook, the update solves a long-standing organization problem. It means finally being able to find that picture of your friend's dog from 2013 or the selfie your mom posted from Mount Rushmore in 2009 without 20 minutes of scrolling. To make photos searchable, Facebook analyzes every single image uploaded to the site, generating rough descriptions of each one. The data is publicly available. There's even a Chrome extension that will show you what Facebook's artificial intelligence thinks is in each picture, and the descriptions can also be read out loud for the Facebook users who are vision impaired. For now, the image descriptions are vague, but expect them to get a lot more precise. Today's announcement specified the AI can identify the color and type of clothes a person is wearing, as well as famous locations and landmarks, objects, animals, and scenes, garden, beach, etc. Facebook's head of AI research, Yann, Y-A-N-N, LeCun, capital L-E-C-U-N, told reporters that that same functionality would eventually come for videos, too. Well, again, just picture people like Campbell Brown and Tucker Bounds and Steve Bannon and Robert and Rebecca Mercer to be working inside of an institution that has these kinds of capabilities and using Cambridge Analytica to help to sort things out for them. Something to bear in mind is what we spoke about in For the Record 945. Steve Bannon now will be, in addition to being the most important of Donald Trump's advisors, Steve Bannon is now on the NSC, outranking in that regard the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and also the director of national intelligence. Steve Bannon is a major functionary of the, quote, alt-right, unquote. Leave it to the U.S. to develop a politically correct term for fascist or Nazi. Steve Bannon is very much part and parcel to the alt-right milieu. One of the things that I noted in For the Record 945 is that the martial law contingency plans that were on the books, that have been on the books ever since they were drawn up by Oliver North during the Reagan administration, those martial law contingency plans involve the deputizing of paramilitary right-wingers and their elevation as federal agents in the event of a declaration of martial law, and they will be keeping the public, quote, order, unquote. Just think about the Serpent's Walk scenario that I have talked about before, and also Steve Bannon's position on the National Security Council. Also, bear in mind what Steve Bannon actually thinks. An interesting post here by Eli Stoklos, S-T-O-K-O-L-S, Stoklos, last name capital S-T-O-K-O-L-S. This is from Politico of February 7th of 2017 by Eliana Johnson, E-L-I-A-N-A Johnson, and Eli Stoklos. What Steve Bannon wants you to read. Subtitle, President Trump's strategic advisor is elevating a once obscure network of political advisors and of political thinkers, Skipping down. The first weeks of the Trump presidency have brought as much focus on the White House's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, as on the new president himself. But if Bannon has been the driving force behind the frenzy of activity in the White House, less attention has been paid to the network of political philosophers who have shaped his thinking and who now enjoy a direct line to the White House. These are not mainstream thinkers, but their writings help to explain the commotion that has defined the Trump administration's early days. They include a Lebanese-American author known for his theories about hard-to-predict events, an obscure Silicon Valley computer scientist whose online political tracts herald a dark enlightenment, and a former Wall Street executive who urged Donald Trump's election in anonymous manifestos by likening the trajectory of the country to that of a hijacked airplane, and who now works for the National Security Council. Skipping down. Speaking of Bannon, but said the source who requested anonymity to speak candidly about Bannon, there are some things he's only going to share with people who he's tight with and who he trusts, unquote. Bannon's readings tend to have one thing in common, the view that technocrats have put Western civilization on a downward trajectory, and that only a shock to the system can reverse its decline. And they tend to have a dark, apocalyptic tone that at times echoes Bannon's own public remarks over the years, a sense that humanity is at a hinge point in history. His ascendant presence in the West Wing is giving once obscure intellectuals unexpected influence over the highest echelons of government. And again, with people like Eric Prince, the founder of the artists formerly known as Blackwater, being a behind-the-scenes advisor to Trump, he is the brother of Betsy DeVos, the new education secretary, also very close with Campbell Brown, one of the key new people with Facebook News. This is an interesting combination. If, in fact, again, note this, Bannon's readings tend to have one thing in common, the view that technocrats have put Western civilization on a downward trajectory and that only a shock to the system can reverse its decline. And they tend to have a dark, apocalyptic tone that at times echoes Bannon's own public remarks over the years, a sense that humanity is at a hinge point in history. Bear in mind in this context, before we continue, something that Donald Trump's whole Legion of Doom cabinet is so freighted with people who properly belong in a 1950s science fiction or horror movie that some of them appear to have sort of gone under the radar. It was not until I was reading a copy of The Economist magazine, a conservative but generally pretty credible British publication, that I learned that the person in charge of cybersecurity for Donald Trump is, drumroll please, fanfare, Rudy Giuliani, which should scare the you-know-what out of people. Well, of course, Rudy Giuliani does have a pretty good track record, and he may not know much about cybersecurity, but at least he can prove that when he has ruled the roost, terrorism does not occur in his principality on his watch. Well, not too much, because he was the mayor of New York when the September 11th attacks happened. And he knows as much, being absolutely, you know, leaving aside the sarcasm. Rudy Giuliani knows as much about cybersecurity as he does about radio astronomy. He knows nothing about cybersecurity, but then that may be the point. I think the possibility of a major shock to the system, again, some sort of horrible incident, very possibly a cyber terrorist incident, or now that Trump has thoroughly ticked off the Muslim world and also the Mexicans, we may see a synthesis of Islamist terrorists and drug traffickers from the three borders area in which Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay all joined together or very closely. Not incidentally, an area that is in the same area as the former Borman Ranch in Latin America. And that is an area that has, again, seen Islamist terror, Nazi elements, and drug traffickers, and organized criminals of all kinds networking with each other. And the elements leading to September 11th have networked there as well.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
More about the friends and literary influences of Stephen Bannon. Before he emerged on the political scene, an obscure Silicon Valley computer programmer with ties to Trump backer and PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel, I would also say major Facebook investor Peter Thiel, was explaining his behavior. Curtis C-U-R-T-I-S, Yarvin, Y-A-R-V-I-N, the self-proclaimed neo-reactionary, unquote, who blogs under the name Mencius Moldbug, M-E-N-C-I-U-S, Moldbug, M-O-L-D-B-U-G, attracted a following in 2008 when he published a wordy treatise asserting, among other things, that, quote, nonsense is a more effective organizing tool than the truth, unquote. When the organizer of a computer science conference canceled Yarvin's appearance following an outcry over his blogging under his nom de web, Bannon took notice. Breitbart News decried the act of censorship in an article about the programmer blogger's dismissal. Moldbug's dense, discursive musings on history. What's so bad about the Nazis, unquote, he asks in one 2008 post that condemns the Holocaust but questions the moral superiority of the Allies, include a belief in the utility of spreading misinformation that now looks like a template for Trump's approach to truth. To believe in nonsense is an unforgeable, unforgettable demonstration of loyalty. It serves as a political uniform, and if you have a uniform, you have an army, he writes in the May 2008 post. Again, to believe in nonsense is a demonstration of loyalty. It serves as a political uniform, and if you have a uniform, you have an army, unquote, he writes in the May 2008 post. In one January of 2008 post titled How I Stopped Believing in Democracy, unquote, he decries the, quote, Georgetownist worldview of elites like the late diplomat George Kennan. Well, with people of that orientation, People who think that, like Oswald Spengler, whose Decline of the West was a major influence on Francis Parker Yaki and the German Conservative Revolution, as we have looked at in, among other programs, some of our visits with Kevin Coogan, the brilliant author of the book Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Post-War Fascist International, one of the best books about fascism. Oswald Spengler in the Decline of the West held a view not unlike that of Curtis Yarvin and Steve Bannon. And when they feel that what the system needs is a, quote, shock, unquote, well, you may find yourself being very shocked, Only you won't be getting your winnings, sir. No, not by a long shot. I am in my 38th year on the air, all of it basically based here in the Silicon Valley. It is interesting to me to have watched the Valley's main explicit focus going from defense. The largest employer in the Valley for a long time was Lockheed Missiles and Space and Sunnyvale, and there were many other major defense firms here in the Valley. Now, the major focal point is consumer electronics. And yet, behind the scenes, not only do many of these civilian consumer electronics companies actually have some pretty interesting national security associations and applications, but really when one looks behind the scenes, despite the fact that many of the employees and many of the executives with many of the high-tech firms here in the Valley are quite liberal and supportive of Democrats, an awful lot of them are not. We will wind up by, with this cautionary note, I have been warning people about the Valley. The last thing the average American should be worried about is the NSA. I mean, if you can do something dumb, like visit ISIS websites, or go online to look for instructions about how to build a bomb or something, well, you know, you're going to draw the NSA's interest. But they really could give a flying you-know-what about the average citizen. But these tech firms, they are interested in every last detail of your life, and they are getting it. And in most cases, you're handing it right to them. And it is not just Facebook or WikiLeaks, not a Silicon Valley outfit, but an online entity. Certainly others as well. This from the New York Times of January 12th of 2017, an article by Thomas B. as in boy, Edsall, capital E-B-S-A-L-L. Silicon Valley takes a right turn. In 2016, corporate PACs associated with Microsoft, Facebook, Google, and Amazon broke ranks with the traditional allegiance of the broad tech sector to the Democratic Party. All four donated more money to Republican congressional candidates than they did to their Democratic opponents. All these technology firms had become corporate behemoths. Their concerns over government regulatory policy have intensified on issues including privacy, taxation, automation, and antitrust. These are questions on which they appear to view Republicans as stronger allies than Democrats. And skipping down. Google's PAC gave 56% of its 2016 contributions to Republicans and 44% to Democrats. And one of the article, one thing the article notes is that a recent Oxfam study found that there were 8 billionaires who put together controlled more wealth than the bottom half of the Earth's population combined, and 4 of them were Jeff Bezos of Amazon and the Washington Post, Bill Gates of Microsoft, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, and Larry Ellison of Oracle. And you put in some of these other people, and you have a true engine of destruction, or a virtual panopticon, in this case, Facebook. This concludes For the Record program number 946, In Your Facebook, a Virtual Panopticon, Part 2, being recorded on February 9th of 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.